Jacksonville. It's been, I think, Alan, probably over 10 or 12 years ago that I came, and I don't guess you all were in this building at that time. It doesn't seem like it, but I was able to be here a number of years ago and visit with you all. It's good to be back, and it's good to get to see you all. I appreciate the opportunity to speak on this topic. This is something I'm very passionate about. I have a lot of interest in. I do want to preface it. There's going to be a lot of technical jargon and complex language, it's not so that I can feel smart or that I can make anybody feel less smart. I do it because I believe it is my duty, my responsibility as a scientist to try to convey this information as accurately as possible. Because I don't want to be accused when all this, when I get up and speak or I write, I don't ever want to be accused of not understanding the things that I'm trying to communicate. And so I will use some language, some big words that cost a lot to use, but hopefully that doesn't offend anybody. Hopefully you understand I'm trying to do it to keep up with what the technical jargon is. And our students in the audience who are reading some of these textbooks now and learning some of these concepts will probably recognize a lot of these. So no offense to the parents and grandparents, but I'll be speaking a lot to our young people tonight because some of them are learning these concepts in school, and I want them to be able to understand the concepts and to understand perhaps a little different perspective on some of those concepts than they might typically receive in the classroom. Again, I appreciate the opportunity to be here with you tonight. As we get started, a number of years ago when I was in high school, I remember walking into freshman biology class, freshman honors biology. Mrs. Perkins was my teacher. She was a wonderful lady, very polite and good at what she did. She was a very accomplished teacher. And walking into Mrs. Perkins' class, I learned very quickly that Mrs. Perkins had a very different view of life than I was raised understanding. Mrs. Perkins taught us very readily that life somehow originated several billion years ago from an initial source that over time gave rise to all the complexity that we see today, and eventually gave rise to organisms that gave rise to other organisms that eventually gave rise to other organisms that eventually gave rise to people, and that's where we are today. And Mrs. Perkins taught that from our biology textbooks, straight from the books, as she was told to do so by the state of Illinois, as just about every state in the United States tells our teachers to do. And I didn't agree with that. And let me preface this to our young people especially. I responded very poorly to my teacher those years. I responded disrespectfully to her, and I do not encourage any of you to directly debate with your teachers, especially in class. Now, if you want to have a private discussion with them afterward and perhaps share with them some things you've learned, I encourage that, but I discourage debate in the classroom setting. And I do that for a couple reasons. One is it's rarely ever fruitful. It rarely ever does anything beneficial. And in fact, it usually just makes the teacher really annoyed at you, if anything else. The other thing it does is I think it hurts the overall cause. And what do I mean by that? I mean, when we debate our teachers in front of our classmates, typically your classmates are not going to take your side. Typically, they're going to look at you as if, why are you interrupting class? Why are you making this take longer than it should? Why are you being the know-it-all, et cetera, et cetera? And I think it's rarely, if ever, fruitful for us young people to debate with our teachers in class. Now, if you get some of these materials, perhaps, that are being provided here, and you want to take those to your teacher and after class suggest that maybe they might read something in there that might be useful to them, I think that's perfect. Now, open up a conversation, open up a dialogue, much like you would do an evangelist, right? If you're going to try to tell somebody about Jesus Christ, it's probably not good to start with telling them how lost they are, all right? We typically need to start at some other place, and I think the same is true with regard to teaching others and helping inform others about some other views that are out there with regards to the scientific evidence and research that's out there. So something that I've that kind of sparked in me in those conversations and in the teaching that I received from Mrs. Perkins, there was something in me that said, I just don't buy this. I just don't buy it. There's something in it that just doesn't fit. And as I've read and studied and learned, I look at passages like Romans chapter 1 and verse 20, where Paul tells us the invisible things of him, for his invisible attributes, excuse me, I'm reading a different version, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made, so that they are without excuse. What is Paul saying here? Paul is telling us that the invisible attributes, namely God's eternal power and divine nature, are clearly perceived. I'm not a Greek scholar, but I understand from Greek scholars that the term there, it refers to rational human-type perception, right? Logical perception. We can perceive, since the creation of the world, in the things that have been made, those attributes of God. What does that mean? To me, that means I can go out here and walk right outside this building and look around at nature. For that, I can just look at other people and recognize in the things that have been made, that's you and me, and that's the grass, and that's the trees, and that's this planet, and that's the sun. I can perceive God's power and divine nature. And I still believe that is true today. And that it's with that mindset that I entered college and graduate school to study and pursue these concepts, because I believe in what has been made, we can learn a lot about God. We can learn a lot about this planet and how it operates, but in what has been made, we can learn a whole lot, I believe, about God. And so that's the attitude and mindset I have this evening as we begin discussing these things. And so I'd like to ask the question, do biological molecules provide evidence of design? Do they? I think that's a fair question. What do I mean by that? Let's break down that statement for just a moment. Biological molecules, we're talking about the molecules that make up living organisms, and we'll define what those are in a moment. Do they provide evidence of design? We understand the concept of design for those of you ladies, like interior design. You like the thought of having your home neatly and nicely decorated and designed. You want it to look nice, right? And there is effort that takes place to cause that to come into being. I was in graduate school with a friend of mine, and his wife was an interior designer, which my understanding is, from discussions with her, that is very different from an interior decorator, okay? And don't confuse the two, because you'll offend somebody. But an interior designer has essentially abilities to work almost like an architect of a room, right? They can knock out walls and move things around and so forth. But there's a process that takes place, right? There's thought that goes into it. There's planning. There's preparation. And so as we talk about biological molecules, let's ask ourselves, is there evidence that these molecules perhaps didn't just happen by accident? Maybe they actually were designed. Maybe they were brought about for a purpose and for a reason. And so that's what we're going to talk about tonight. So what's life made of? Well, life is really hard to define. You read any number of textbooks, you'll get any number of answers. We don't have a one set definition of life. And those of you scientists perhaps in the audience will recognize that. There's no one single definition of life, because every time we make one, we find something that doesn't quite fit that. Right? To say something is alive if it breathes doesn't really apply to some organisms that don't undergo aerobic respiration. Right? Things that don't breathe wouldn't be alive. But there are plenty of things that don't really breathe that are alive. And so we can't really have a single definition, but what we do know about life is that it's compartmentalized. And so we know that life at its basic unit we call a cell. And so individual cells make up living organisms. Some organisms are single cell. They got one cell, bacteria. You've heard of E. coli? That's a single cell living organism. That's the picture on the left-hand side. Right, that's an electron micrograph of E. coli cells. Okay. If you look on the right-hand side, that's a tissue slice from human tissue. Right? Human tissues are made up of many cells. In fact, in each of us, there are somewhere around 100 trillion cells. Right? Yes, that number does actually exceed the national debt, right? And so 100 trillion cells make up the human body. That's a whole lot of cells. The cells in our bodies are organized into tissues, and tissues, in turn, are organized in at the next step, right, into organs. Organs are organized into organ systems, and then all the organ systems come together to make up our body, right? So there are certain cells that are muscle cells that work together in what we call our muscular tissue, right? The same thing could be said of bones, our cardiovascular system. Each of those, when you break it down, there are different types of cells that make up the various tissues. The heart has specialized tissue in it, some of which is muscle that contracts very regularly, and we're all thankful for that it operates the way that it should. in order to force blood throughout our circulatory system. And so organisms that are multicellular have some kind of system set up like this. Now, not all organisms have all of those parts. Plants kind of have a different way of describing it, but humans and animals, we could probably fairly easily describe just the way we did there. One of my college textbooks had what I thought is one of the best single statements I've seen about a living cell. Now, let me preface this. The folks that wrote this textbook are evolutionists. I don't know if they're atheists or not, but they don't believe that it was designed. But listen to what they say about a living cell. They say that a living cell is a self-contained, self-assembling, self-perpetuating, self-adjusting, constant temperature system of molecules that extracts free energy and raw materials from its environment. That sounds like a fairly sophisticated machine, if you think about it. We would all love to have a home that fixes itself, right? Amen? Love to have a roof that repairs itself when it leaks. Love to have a water heater that can repair itself when it goes out. I'd love to have a car that could change its own oil, all right? Cells, in their own way, have the ability to overcome numerous types of challenges and to adjust and to correct and to fix and repair things when needed. Now, that's not always the case. Sometimes the cell can't make it. You can see on the right-hand side kind of a diagram of a cell, a drawing of a cell from a common textbook, and that matches what you see from a lot of other textbooks. There's this bilayer on the outside made of lipids, and then inside the cell you've got a number of different things. This is a eukaryotic cell, which is what we have, right? Bacteria don't have a nucleus. We call that prokaryotes. Humans and other organisms that are eukaryotes have what we call nuclei in the middle of the cell, and that's where the DNA is contained. We'll talk about that in a moment. But there are all those components inside the cell, and they're organized, and they do various functions. Some of them serve essentially as a production assembly line, a factory. Some of these molecules are involved in transport. Some of them are involved in importing and exporting molecules. Some of them are involved in processing various things that have been brought into the cell or that are leaving the cell. And so there are a number of different things taking place in the cell at any given time. And it takes a number of things for this to happen. Cells, which are membrane-bound structures, typically have about four different types of biological molecules in them. And so this is broad classes. So amino acids, which are the building blocks of proteins. Proteins are very important. They make up some of the most important functional elements in your cells. And so amino acids are the building blocks of proteins. There's about 20 different standard amino acids. There's some extra ones here and there, but in general, there's 20 amino acids. Carbohydrates, things like sugars, glucose, right? These are very important in the cell as well, and they serve a number of different functions, as we'll talk about in a few minutes. Some of these can be linked together in long chains as polysaccharides. Some of them stay as individual sugars. Lipids, which are fats and oils and things like this. You may think about triglycerides or triacylglycerols. These are different types of fatty molecules. Steroid hormones fall into this class. You've heard of testosterone, right? Progesterone, estrogen. These are steroid hormones that are produced in the cells for different purposes. Cholesterol is the precursor of all those steroid hormones. So for all the bad press cholesterol gets, it's very important in our cells and serves some very important functions, and that's a lipid. Nucleic acids are something that you've probably heard a lot about in the media because they're very popular, right? DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, RNA, ribonucleic acid. This is the fourth major biological molecule in the cell, and it's made up of nucleotides, right? The DNA nucleotides we call A, C, G, and T, adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine. And then there's uracil, which is in RNA as opposed to the thymine, which is in DNA. And so there are a few nucleotides that come together, make these really, really long chains that we call things like DNA. And so these molecules can take different shapes, and of course we've got them all colored here on this diagram, but in reality they wouldn't necessarily be colored. Up in the top left-hand side, you've got a protein, and that's actually hemoglobin that is fluctuating between an oxygenated state and a deoxygenated state. Then you have other molecules up in the top right-hand side. You have things like carbohydrates and the complex structure that is glycogen in the top right corner. Lower left corner, you have some examples of lipids, and then the lower right, DNA and RNA. So these are the molecules that come together in different ways and in different types to make up a functioning cell. And again, I told you earlier that you have how many cells? About 100 trillion cells. Each of these 100 trillions of cells have millions and millions of these molecules to make up those cells. So when you think about it on a biological level, we have a lot of stuff in here, okay? Whole lot of stuff going on. And so I think it's important for us to ask the question, is there a way for us to kind of detect design in all of this? How do we detect that? And I don't know that I have a good answer, but let me give you a couple analogies. Driving from where we live in Tennessee to where I work in Nashville, I have to get on the interstate. And near the interstate exit, there's a little grass area just by a gas station right before you get on the interstate. And a couple weeks ago, I started noticing something pop up above the ground in that grassy area. And within about a week or so, I realized that there were flowers, and they were starting to bloom because of the unusually warm weather we've been having. There was something interesting about these flowers. They weren't just in rows. They were in the shape of letters. And it spelled out spring. In perfect English letters, spring. In little yellow flowers, and I wish I had a picture of it, I'd show it to you. And I just drove on assuming that someone just, you know, that those flowers just happened randomly, right? Is that a safe assumption? Why not, right? Each one of us, when we see something like that, what do we assume? We assume somebody took the time, got down on their knees, right, and planted those flowers in an arrangement so that once they came up, which I assume they were expecting that would be in a month or two, right? Not right now, right before frost, they'll probably all die. But I think the assumption was they'll pop up in springtime and everybody will get a good laugh out of it. Well, we're laughing anyway. But we realized that somebody had to do that. Somebody actually had to physically plant those flowers in that shape. None of us would assume what? We wouldn't assume that it happened by accident. And we use that kind of logic all the time to make inferences about things that we experience and see, right? We make inferences about what things happened by accident and what things were caused. And I think it's safe for us to assume that somebody planted those flowers, and there's actually a word before spring, but it hasn't sprouted enough yet for me to tell what it is, right? So it says something else, and I can't wait for the rest of the message to get there. But the point is, I never once assumed that those flowers happened randomly. I assumed that it was by design. Can we do the same thing with biological molecules? Can we make the same types of assumptions? How about another analogy, something we use all the time? There are a number of computers, more computers than I can count in that room over there, Alan, a bunch of them, right? When we look at computers, what do we assume? We assume somebody designed them. I've got an iPad here, and I think it's pretty safe to assume, especially since it's been in the media, how much people get paid to make these. We assume that this was a designed product, right? It didn't just happen. I mean, it's not a whole lot of anything, really. It's a lot smaller and lighter than some of the first computers and can do a whole lot more. But we assume that this was designed, that there was planning and preparation that went into the development of that device. Computers have information. We typically think of that as stored on a hard drive. I know that's changing because now we have flash drives that don't operate the same way as the standard disk in a hard drive. And all that's evolving, I understand. But we do understand that information in the computer would imply what? An operating system is designed. My brother works professionally as a software architect. I don't know what it means. Sounds really cool. But from what I understand of what he does, he can design solutions for companies that have a specific computing need. If you need your computer to do a particular function, he works to design how that happens. And so there's a lot of design and architecture in that process of figuring out how to make a computer do a particular thing, and that requires information. We also understand about computers that there's something called interdependence. I don't know, maybe I made this word up, but let's see if it works, right? What I mean by that is that the parts of a computer really depend upon one another. A hard drive wouldn't mean a whole lot if you didn't have anything like an operating system to operate the information on the hard drive. It also wouldn't mean anything if you didn't have a motherboard. I don't even know if they still put those in computers, but that's the way it used to be. You had a motherboard, you had a processor, and all of that worked with the hard drive. And then you had to have some way to put information in, right? Keyboard, mouse. You had to have some way to get information out. Maybe that's a monitor, maybe that's a printer. So there's interdependence between these various features. And not only that, there's integration. Integration in the sense that when you move the mouse, it causes a response so that you can see what's happening on the monitor. Right? You can see what's happening in our Windows-based systems as you open and close programs, as you edit information and documents. And so I think we can see very easily that computers have what I consider to be three kind of suggestions of design, and that is information, interdependence, and integration. Do biological molecules provide the same type of evidence? If we're looking out in nature, if we're looking at the biological molecules that make up cells, can we find evidence of information? Secondly, can we find evidence of interdependence? And third, can we find evidence of integration? All right, these are the three points I want to look at just briefly this evening. To do that, we need to have a little bit of biology and biochemistry 101, maybe 102, maybe 202, I don't know. We'll get there. I do want to introduce you to the concept of the double helix of DNA in case you haven't studied that before. So back in 1953, based upon some very astute observations by Francis, Drs. Crick and Watson, what they found, using information that they gleaned from their own studies, along with information from X-ray crystallography done by Rosalind Franklin, we want to make sure she gets credit, they were able to surmise that DNA is in a double helical shape. In other words, it's two strands, and they're anti-parallel, meaning they run opposite directions, and then they wind around one another. And so that gives us that double helical structure that we're used to seeing in textbooks and in other images. This double helical structure results from the nature and the structure of the nucleotide bases in DNA. So what do I mean by a nucleotide base? And that's these structures over here. So there are four different types of nucleotides, as we mentioned earlier, in DNA. A, T, G, and C is what we'll call them for short tonight. And what you can see is that each one of these has a phosphate group, a sugar group, and then what we call the nucleotide base itself. So this is the actual base, and that's why we call them base pairs. What we've learned, and thanks to Watson and Crick, we've learned that base pairs pair up in a regular order. In other words, A pairs with T and G pairs with C across the double helix. So this is one strand on the left-hand side, a second strand on the right-hand side, and they pair across the double helix with one another. And that bonding between them offers some strength. The bonds individually are weak, but when you have a strand of 1,000 or 1,000,000 base pairs, it becomes pretty strong over time. So these base pairs pair across the helix and cause the twisting of the entire double helix, basically because of the structure of each of those nucleotide pairs. So in DNA, what we don't typically see, just two of these pairs, of course, chromosomes in your cells have somewhere on the order of 5 million to 25 million base pairs. So they're actually pretty long, so really, really long. And in fact, if we took the DNA from one of your cells and stretched it out, just one of your cells that has two copies of everything, right? One copy from mom, one copy from dad, stretch that out end to end, it's about 6 feet long, which is pretty impressive considering the fact that you can't really even see a single cell with your naked eye. In most cases, there are a few cells that are large enough, but in general, a single cell is extremely small. And you take all the DNA from that, and it's 6 feet long, compacted into that space. Talk about a nightmare, right? You ever tried to get the Christmas lights out when they all get in one box, right? What happens? It's like, just forget it, I'm going and buying new ones, right? This year we're getting LEDs, all right? But you get the point. It's a long, long piece of DNA compacted in a very small space. And you have a lot of chromosomes, you know, 46, two copies of everything in each cell. So biological molecules, do they contain information? The answer is yes, they do. Let's talk about that information in a minute. The nucleotides are in a specific order in the backbone of DNA. So A, G, T, and C aren't just in a repeating pattern, but rather they're in a very specified order that actually conveys information. And this is organized, as we've already mentioned, into chromosomes. So how much information is there? The human genome, one copy, has about 3.2 billion base pairs. The estimates are that's roughly 20 to 25,000 genes are in that information. By comparison, bacteria like E. coli have about 5 million base pairs. And this last one, Mycoplasma genitalium, which is a parasitic form of bacteria, is one of the smallest known free-living types of bacteria, and has about 500,000 base pairs in its genome. And that's going to become important a little bit later. It's about 480 genes, and we'll bring it back up and discuss it again in a little bit. To give you a little bit of a comparison, what does this look like? What's 3.2 billion base pairs? Well, if you wrote that out on 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper in 12-point Times Roman font, single-spaced, I estimated you could get roughly 3,500 characters on a page. So for the human genome to be typed out, 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper, 12-point font, 3,500 characters a page approximately, it's going to take you 942,000 pages. That's a long book, right? Most of our young people don't want to read a textbook that long, right? Well, some evolutionists would say, well, that's good because actually only about 2% of that DNA is useful. To which I respond, that's still 20,000 pages of information that is supposedly all that's useful. And in reality, the most current estimates I've seen are that at least 10% of the information in the genome has a known function, meaning that we bump that up again, right? So there's somewhere around 95,000 pages in there that actually we know for sure has a function. And so there's another large amount that we still don't know yet exactly what that function might be, and we'll come back to that in a minute. But hopefully that gives you some idea of how much information we're talking about, all right? So we're talking about the actual base pairs of DNA, the sequence of those base pairs. So what order are the A, G, T, and C in, and how does that order then convey information? Let me give you this little analogy here. William Dembski is an intelligent design proponent, and one of his favorite things to study has to do with complexity and information theory. And what he says about this concept of complexity and design is that a single letter of the alphabet is specified without being complex. A long sentence of random letters is complex without being specified. He says a Shakespearean sonnet is both complex and specified. We would all agree that if we were to come upon randomly some sheets of paper laying on the ground that just had random letters on it, we wouldn't be that impressed, would we? But if we happened upon a manuscript written by Shakespeare, that would be a little more impressive. Why? Because that complex specified information has the ability to communicate something. And that's the way the genome works. It communicates information, right? There is information in the DNA. And it's important for us to understand that because once we understand that there's information in it, we can start to ask the question, where did that information come from and how is it used? Let's take a little history lesson for just a moment. There's a concept in molecular biology known as the central dogma. It's been around for a number of years. And the concept is that DNA goes through a process we call transcription to make RNA. And we'll talk about that in just a moment. And then that RNA can be translated into something we call protein. All right. It has been assumed for a long time that the important parts of DNA are the parts that make protein. So the parts that actually code for information that makes RNA, which makes protein. We're starting to understand more and more that that's not all there is. And we'll talk about that here in just a few minutes as well. But what I want you to understand is that this has been the prevailing concept, that the important parts of DNA have to do with those parts that end up coding for some kind of protein, making some protein in the end. And so you'll hear these words like genome. You've heard of the human genome. That's all of the genes of an organism, right? Not the blue genes, not Levi's. RNA, all of the RNA that is produced in a given cell we call the transcriptome. And then all the proteins that are made in a given cell, we call the proteome. All right, so there's all these fancy ohm terms now, and they're used very commonly in science. There's another process that takes place whereby DNA is copied, and we call that DNA replication or DNA synthesis, and that's what that looping arrow is on the top. So the general processes that have been understood for several years now are that DNA gets transcribed to RNA, which gets translated to protein. So what does that look like? This little schematic I recreated from a textbook, and we've got DNA that has two strands, right? It's got what we call a coding strand and a template strand. And what happens is there's a group of molecular machinery that we call the RNA polymerase. And that's a series of proteins that grab onto the DNA at specific points. They're able to separate the two strands, and they basically ride along the DNA, reading the DNA as they go. All right? And so as they read the DNA, there's a group of machinery that for every one of the thymines will place an RNA adenine. For every adenine, it places an RNA uracil. For every cytosine, it places an RNA guanine. And on it goes, placing each of these letters opposite of what it would naturally pair with, on down the line. And so that produces an RNA molecule as it goes. So as it reads the DNA, it puts a complementary RNA molecule in that place. All right, so that's transcription. That's taking DNA and making RNA. We call it transcription. That RNA transcript now goes out of the nucleus, if you're a eukaryotic cell, and the machinery outside of the nucleus called the ribosome grabs onto this piece of RNA. It then can read the RNA molecule and go right on down the line and place amino acids in place. And what happens is for every three nucleotides, there is a specific amino acid that is put in place. So three nucleotides together code for one amino acid, and we call that a codon. So the codon is three ribonucleotides, three RNA nucleotides that code for a single amino acid. And so as you go along, AUG is methionine, CCA is proline, and then valine and glycine, and so on and so forth. And so each of the amino acids, they have a much longer name, but we abbreviate them. We have one letter and three letter abbreviations. So the protein gets built codon by codon, individual amino acid by individual amino acid. Now what happens to this protein? So this growing protein chain starts to fold into a three-dimensional shape. And that three-dimensional shape, as we'll talk about in just a moment, is what determines the function and the structure of that particular protein. So we've seen the process then where DNA goes to RNA, we call that transcription. RNA goes to protein, we call that translation, much like translating from English to Spanish, right? We're taking one language, the nucleotide language, and we're making it a different language. We're making it the protein language, which is an amino acid language. And so we have a translator taking place. That's pretty impressive, right? In your cells all the time. You don't even have to think about it. Pretty cool, right? You don't even have to tell it to happen. Your hundreds of millions and billions of cells are doing it all the time. There are 20 standard amino acids. I don't expect you to memorize all of these, just half of them, and draw them when we're done. These are the amino acids. The difference in each of the amino acids has to do with the blue box part down here, the R group. Each one has a different R group. The different R groups have different properties. Those properties then have the ability to do different things in the context of a full protein. So amino acid sequence determines how the protein folds three-dimensionally and determines how it functions. All right, so these things come together. So if you notice up here, the vast majority of possible amino acid sequences don't really make anything useful. In other words, you can't just throw a string of amino acids together and get a functional protein. It's a highly specific order. My analogy for you is we could take a series of letters. Let's say some of you all have magnetic letters on your refrigerator, maybe, right? I'm expecting that we'll probably get a set of those before too long, right? So what do those magnetic letters on the refrigerator do? They just kind of hang out there, right, in random order until somebody does what? Arranges them in a useful order. Well, if, let's say your two-year-old gets a hold of them, starts lining them up, what's the possibility or the probability that it's going to make something meaningful? I don't know, right? Maybe they're really good and they know their words really well. But there's a possibility that it's going to be gibberish, right? The same kind of concept applies to amino acids. There has to be a proper order of these amino acids to make something functional. Just like in any language, we have to put letters together in the right order to form the right types of words in order for it to be functional, in order for it to carry meaning. There are a whole lot of combinations of English letters that are completely meaningless to most of us, right? The same thing is true with amino acids and proteins. There are a number of ways you can combine them, and it doesn't mean anything. The cool thing about our cells is they don't do that, right? They have things in the correct order, and they combine them. Now, there's room for variation. In my graduate work, for example, I studied an enzyme where we were able to change individual amino acids here and there and still get a protein that could do something. It still could function, though it was kind of handicapped, all right? We kind of handicapped it a little bit by changing those. On a more medically related level, sickle cell anemia results from a single amino acid change. And so in sickle cell individuals, one of the changes that could happen is a glutamate amino acid could be changed to a valine. That single amino acid change in a very long protein chain causes a kind of a clumping to occur because now this valine fits into a pocket. And ultimately, since the hemoglobin clumps together, the cell no longer has a normal circular shape, but is now a sickle cell shape. Now, that does confer some resistance to malaria. However, those cells are short-lived. These individuals still deal with a number of issues related to having anemia. And so it's not necessarily a truly beneficial thing to have that, though it can be in certain circumstances. But this all results from a single amino acid change. How did that amino acid change? It changed because the DNA changed, right? There was a change in the backbone of DNA. Some actual nucleotides are different. And since three nucleotides code for one amino acid, it's very likely that only one or two nucleotides had to change for this particular change to occur. Okay? And so that's an example of one way that we see this happening in our lives. Now, there are other examples. Muscular dystrophy is an example of something that occurs because of one or two nucleotides being changed or deleted. And if you know anybody that deals with muscular dystrophy, the dystrophin protein is malformed, isn't produced properly because of some simple changes in the amino acid structure. All right. So information, how is it used? It's used in several ways. As we've just seen, the information in DNA is used to make RNA. Some of that RNA is then used to make protein, but not all of it, and we'll talk about why that is in just a moment. DNA is used in a number of other ways. It can be used as a means of controlling what we call the expression of other regions of DNA. What do I mean by gene expression? I mean the actual production of a protein product from a given piece of DNA. So we used to talk about genes, and we'd say, like Mendel would, Gregor Mendel, who was the pioneer of what we call modern genetics, as he did his studies, right? He found that there were certain traits that could be inherited as he bred different types of plants together. And so we used to talk about traits and genes as the same thing, and they're not really. So Liz and I both have brown hair and brown eyes. It's a pretty safe assumption that Lucy's going to have brown hair and brown eyes, right? But she might not, because the reality is, traits don't always work that way. It's not a simple one-to-one ratio as far as genes and traits. And so gene expression has to do with which protein products are produced, right, and how much of those protein products are produced in a given genome. I think it's safe to assume that if you're in a muscle cell, you're going to express the proteins needed to be a muscle cell. But if you're a skin cell, you're going to produce different proteins than you would if you were a muscle cell. Right? Those red blood cells we just showed you a minute ago produce different proteins like hemoglobin so that they can transport oxygen. Well, not all the cells in our body need hemoglobin, just the red blood cells, really. So not all of the cells in our body are going to express hemoglobin. So that's what we mean when we say gene expression. And so DNA can regulate the production of RNA. We know that some DNA can actually serve as kind of a spatial marker. Remember I said this stuff. These chromosomes are 5 million plus base pairs long. There is actually some DNA in there that's literally just a spacer. It just provides space in the genome so that you can attach the DNA to the inside of the cell, right? So there's some theories that, there's kind of a scaffolding effect that takes place. If you think about having a rope that is that long, it'd be nice to have some segments that you could just use to tether it in place, right? Just to kind of hold things where they are. And there's some theories out there that some of this extra DNA that isn't coding for protein may serve some of those functions. What about RNA? What things can it do? Well, some of it is messenger RNA, and that's the RNA that eventually ends up being translated into protein. Some RNA is what we call ribosomal RNA. In other words, the ribosome, which translates RNA to DNA or RNA to protein, the ribosome is made up of protein enzymes and RNA molecules together. All right? So it is a combination. And the RNA molecules that make that up we call ribosomal RNA. There's also another class called transfer RNA. This is a really interesting class of molecules. Transfer RNA molecules have an essential job in this whole process. We haven't asked the question, how does the cell know which amino acid to put in place and where it puts it? You have to have transfer RNA molecules to translate from the nucleotide language to the amino acid language. And that's the job of a transfer RNA. Transfer RNA molecule really only holds one amino acid, right? And so the net effect of that is when that transfer RNA molecule realizes its turn is up, it gets put in place, and that amino acid gets placed properly. And each transfer RNA molecule comes in at the appropriate time to build that protein chain one amino acid at a time. There are a number of other types of RNA molecules we're not going to go into tonight, but suffice it to say that RNA has a number of important functions in this process as well. Sorry, I'll step back here. So what about non-protein coding DNA? Look at this quote, for example, from Kenneth Miller. He says, the human genome is littered with pseudogenes, gene fragments, orphan genes, junk DNA, and so many repeated copies of pointless DNA sequences that it cannot be attributed to anything that resembles intelligent design. How do we respond to that? Is he right? Is it all hopeless? There's another quote, I don't have it up here, but by Francis Crick and Leslie Orgel, who basically say it's folly to hunt obsessively for a cause for this type, or for a role for this type of DNA. In other words, it's pointless. Why even mess with it, right? Is that the case? Is it safe to assume that there's no function for this DNA just because we don't know of one? I'm going to suggest maybe not. If I'm approaching science from a design perspective and I make the assumption that the things in nature are designed, my assumption is going to be that even though we don't know what this DNA does, that we're going to find perhaps some ways that this DNA is functional and is useful. And as we've studied, what we found, well, I'll let Dr. Francis Crick, who is the director of the NIH, I'll let him answer it. He was one of the leaders of the Human Genome Project. And he says, discoveries of the past decade, little known to most of the public, have completely overturned much of what used to be taught in high school biology. He says, if you thought the DNA molecule comprised thousands of genes, but far more junk DNA, he says, think again. He says, some DNA we used to call junk is useful. And I think that's an important thing for us to point out and to understand. This junk DNA argument is still in many of the textbooks, and it's still used very commonly. And young people, you're still going to have teachers teach it to you for a number of years to come. I want you to be aware, though, that there are a number of uses for what was assumed to be junk DNA. In fact, as we look at the genome as a whole, what we've learned is that most of the DNA in an organism is actually transcribed into RNA. So the assumption is, there must be some function for it, otherwise why would the cell be producing it? It's not going to spend resources producing something that doesn't serve a function, right? That's not productive for an organism to do. That's a waste of time. And so it's important for us to understand that there may be a number of functions that we haven't figured out. Some of those that we have figured out is that some of this non-protein coding DNA that gets made into RNA actually goes on to serve roles in controlling how much of genes are produced and which genes are produced. Some of these sequences we know facilitate the inactivation of certain chromosomes. And so, for example, if you have two X chromosomes, right, as a proportion of our audience here tonight has two X chromosomes, one of those needs to be inactivated. And that process is facilitated by some of this extra DNA that that is not necessarily used to produce protein. So there are a number of functions being found as they study. There are a number of functions that have been found and are being found for some of this previously thought to be junk DNA. Now, I think it's important for us to point out we haven't figured everything out, and we certainly don't know functions for every part of it, but I think it is still safe to assume that there is going to be a larger fraction than we might expect that actually has a function. The other thing I do want to point out, though, is that I think it's also safe to assume that there's quite a bit of DNA in our cells that no longer has a function. In other words, we've been around since the time of Adam, and we've been undergoing decay in that period of time. We've exposed ourselves to a number of types of chemicals and hazards that have caused mutations in our DNA. We've had a number of viruses that have infected us and inserted DNA into our genomes. And so those types of effects are things that we would expect to see. And so we do actually see those things in our genome. So there are parts of our genome that really don't have any function because they are the effects of decay and what I consider to be some of the effects of the fall. And so I think it's important for us to remember that as we have this discussion. Well, let's update our view then of the central dogma just a little bit. So DNA is transcribed RNA, which is translated to protein. And then we know proteins have the ability to convert molecules into other molecules that we call metabolites. And so not only do we have a genome, a transcriptome, a proteome, we also have what we call the metabolome. But there are other things taking place in this model that we need to point out as well. See, we also know that some RNA molecules come back and regulate transcription of other RNA. We know that some protein molecules come back and regulate this process as well. We further know that some protein molecules can regulate translation. To take it another step, we know that there are metabolites that regulate both transcription and translation. And so the picture gets pretty complicated, as you can see. There's a lot of things going on. There's a lot of interacting parts. But the interesting thing is they all work together. And they all work. Another thing I'll point out, if you're a virus, and certain viruses can do this, I don't think I see any viruses here tonight, but if you are a virus, some viruses have the ability to convert RNA back to DNA. We call that reverse transcription. And that's a unique thing, unique to several types of viruses. And that allows viruses to insert their own DNA back into your cell, which is kind of an interesting process. It allows them to be very virulent at times. So let me just summarize this by saying, biological molecules with regard especially to DNA, RNA, and proteins contain a large amount of information. And it's specified complex information that allows for the development of proteins and RNA molecules that carry out the functions of a cell. Are these molecules also interdependent? And I think they are. Biological molecules don't really operate in isolation. In other words, DNA doesn't really do things on its own. It operates in the context of a cell where there's protein and there's RNA molecules and there are other molecules present. There are no DNA enzymes that have been found in nature. I did find one paper where some folks made one artificially, but that was by design. RNA does have some limited ability to be an enzyme, and it has some ability to carry information, but there have been no examples found of RNA that could copy itself, for example, or do things like that. Proteins have broad enzymatic activity. They can do a lot, but they don't really carry information. And so the result is all of these molecules working together are what make a cell. How could this process have begun if we stop and think about it? What molecules could have arisen independently? And how about this last question? What proposed prebiotic conditions could have actually supported the assembly of some of these molecules? And I think that's an important question. And to be fair, there have been a lot of people that have studied this for a number of years. And some of the experiments that were done, like Stanley Miller and Harold Urey, you've seen the Miller-Urey experiments, things like that, where they zap chemicals with electricity and they form some molecules from that. They've been able to get a lot from those types of studies with regard to individual amino acids and nucleotides and sugars. What they haven't been able to show from that is that those then have the ability to produce the complex biological molecules like proteins and the larger macromolecules, RNA and DNA. We're just not able to find that. This doesn't happen. The other thing to point out about those types of experiments are they're very controlled. Okay, they are able to isolate the reaction products before they have time to degrade. I think it's important for us to understand that ability to do that, to interfere with that reaction, is really key to getting those reactions to work. And so I think it's important for us to understand that. But let's just talk about, for one moment here, how these processes kind of are interdependent. DNA can't copy itself. In fact, it's dependent upon a number of proteins to fulfill that. And so we know that in humans, for example, it takes about 30 different proteins to perform DNA synthesis. Even in the simplest organism that we know of that can live on its own, it takes about 30 proteins to undergo DNA repair and replication. In humans, we know that there's about 160 genes when we include those involved in DNA repair. What about transcription? Transcription alone takes 40 different proteins in humans. In this simpler bacteria, it takes at least 10. We also know translation takes over 100 proteins in humans, and even in the simplest organism that we found still takes about 100 different proteins. Energy metabolism, so the production of things like ATP in humans, over 70 proteins. What about the simpler bacteria? Still takes 30 proteins. What's the point? The point is, how could these living organisms have existed unless all of these features had been in place? And this is just a few of the functions. There are so many others that we're not even mentioning. So numerous enzymes and RNA molecules are required for replication, transcription, translation, repair. How did organisms develop unless all of these things arose simultaneously? Right? How could it happen? They're interdependent. And finally, they're integrated. Right? These systems are very integrated. So these classes of biological molecules work together in concert. They perform many different functions in the cell. Signaling molecules, cell surface receptors, signaling cascades, cellular enzymes, transcription factors, all these things work together to perform various functions. Routine cellular processes require a number of different forms of communications, both inside the cell and with other cells around us. Some of you, before you came here, ate. Maybe that's been long enough ago that some of you are falling asleep. That's okay. The foods you ate, some of you may have had pie, and I can tell by the smile on some of your faces you had really good pie, right? Some of that probably had some sugar somewhere in it, right? I imagine there was some sugar involved, okay? What happens when you eat that food? Well, let's skip some of it, right? Let's skip forward until that actual glucose gets into your bloodstream, right? So we're going to skip some of the digestion part and get it straight into your bloodstream. What happens? There are sensor cells in your pancreas that detect the level of glucose in your blood. When that happens, there's a set of cells that quit releasing or lower their release of glucagon, and there's another set of cells that increase their release of insulin. Insulin and glucagon are small proteins. They're peptide hormones. So they have a gene in DNA where they're transcribed RNA, they're translated protein. They get released out of the cell, right? When insulin signaling predominates, what happens? Insulin binds to the insulin receptor, which is another protein on the surface of your cells in the lipid bilayer. Binds to the insulin receptor. That sends a signal cascade going off inside the cell. What happens then? Well, if you're regular body cells, you increase glucose transport. So you start bringing a bunch of glucose in. And then you increase a process called glycolysis, where you break that glucose down and make energy. If you're in cells like the liver, you shut down processes called glycogenolysis, where you're actually breaking down glycogen, and you start the process of glycogenesis, where you build up glycogen. That's the storage form of glucose in our liver. So all of these things have to take place in a very coordinated manner. And there are a number of proteins, a number of signaling factors, a number of enzymes that are required for all of this to take place. And so there's a high degree of integration in the system. We could say the same thing about cellular metabolic pathways, and I want you to memorize at least half of this chart. But as you can see, there's a number of things taking place. This is a simplified version, okay? Seriously, it is. There are a lot of reactions that have to take place. This is not only metabolism of sugars. This is how you produce amino acids. This is how you produce nucleotides, because you got to make nucleotides if you're going to make more DNA and RNA. All of these things have to be made somehow, so you've got enzymes in place to produce all of these factors. They're controlled very, very tightly. They're produced at the right times and in the right amounts, And if things are dysregulated, there are problems. What about other pathways? Blood clotting, innate and adaptive immunity, muscular contraction, vision, speech, hearing, etc. What about reproduction? All of these pathways require a high degree of integration among all of the biological molecules. Requires the genetic information, requires the ability to access the genetic information, requires the ability to use that information to make things. All of this requires a high degree of integration. And so I bring all this together just to say simply, I think that biological molecules provide a stunning amount of evidence for design, both in the information content, the interdependence, and in the integration among these biological molecules in order to sustain and promote life. There are a number of things taking place in your cell that you don't have to think about. You don't have to question. You don't have to wonder about. And so I want you to consider the fact that perhaps you were made by design. I appreciate the opportunity to be with you here tonight. I've enjoyed getting to share this time with you. I've been asked if we would to have a short invitation as we prepare to close. Before we have our invitation, I will ask, are there any questions that I could entertain briefly before we close out? Okay. It's been an honor to get to be with you, and in sharing with you about biological information, I realize I have not been able to refer to Scripture as much as I typically like to. But I do want us to understand the reason we're talking about all of this and the reason we think it's so important. And that has to do with the fact that we understand